They were.
Should we start with a few questions?
Absolutely.
Some very, very basic questions. Okay, so when we apply a pulse and we rotate the system, so what we're doing is that we're applying the pulses along, it's the RF along the x-axis, right? And the rotation that we affected are basically the black pulse waves.
Yeah, so.
Is it easy to get confused about the XYZ rotation in real space? And all right,
so we have a lab frame and a rotating frame. In the lab frame, we have some superconducting magnetic as a B0 field that we've put along the x-axis. And we have a coil. And so we'll call that the x-axis of the laboratory frame. And this field, if we're going to be say it in complete generality, that this field, which we can call B1, has some amplitude like that. And of course, it has some duration. So this is true for, let's put it over here, for 0 is less than t is less than the time of the pulse. So for some interval, we turn that on. And we go to a rotating frame. And to go to the rotating frame, we're going to rotate with this frequency. So here we'll say that we have u is equal to e to the omega t over 2 t sigma z. So it's a rotating frame. And if we drew in the lab frame, in this frame, what we see is that there's the coils along this axis, and that there's an alternating field here. We go into the rotating frame. Then in this case, we're going to have this piece. Remember that we could decompose decompose this into left and right-handed. If we just keep the one that goes to 0, then we have a static field here, always there. So this is static. And in this frame, there's a big field, of course, along B0. And it goes to the difference, right? So yes, it goes away. It goes to some small thing, which is delta omega is equal to omega naught minus omega t. You know, they interact the frequency that we transformed with lower case t. And we're going to evolve around the sum of those. So that when this one goes to 0, which is mostly the time that we assume that this term is 0, then we're just mutating about that field. And of course, here we have a very simple set of dynamics in this frame that we start off along the z, so that would be the spin magnetization. And it would just rotate to the, in this case, the minus y axis. In this frame, okay, you would start off along z because it's a shared coordinate system. I'm going to keep just the rotating piece, and so now what I have is effectively a field that's rotating with omega t. And as I tip this, it's going to follow that field. It's always going to be 90 degrees behind that field, right? There'll be a lag. And so we'll have this spiral type motion. Yeah, and you know, so over there is easier to sort out.
And the pulse is basically the time period for the pulse is Tp.
Yeah.
And it's actually along the x prime.
That's right. And so if we said that there's some angle we want to rotate through, then we know that. Okay. Now, this should be a factor of 2, because I'm going to reduce this to right and left-handed. But since I haven't defined omega 1 over here, I'm just going to define omega 1 at this time. Right? So there would be a factor of 2. But and this frequency is set by the experimentalist. So that's the amplitude of the gain of an RF amplifier. This delay is set through a pulsar. And so all of that is under our control. Yeah?
How do you apply a pulse along the x prime axis if that frame is rotating? I mean, is that rotating frame is what, different for each element in the ensemble? So you can't.
It's a really good question. And, it worried people for a long time. And people fell into three schools. There were those that didn't realize it was a problem. They just built their equipment and it worked. There are those people that realized it was a problem, didn't think it through. They built really complicated equipment that never worked. And then there's those people that thought it through and realized you could just build it simply. So let me show you why that is the case. And if I said that I'm in the lab frame over here, and the spin initially is along z, and we've got this phase over here, so let's keep it. It says that. At time equals 0, whenever that happens to be, I'm going to turn on the RF. And so if phase is 0, I'll turn on the RF here. And if phase, you know, has some other value, I'll turn on the RF here. And this sounds like a problem because it says, well, in the first case, the spins will be rotated into the minus y direction. In the second case, they'll be rotated 90 degrees from this axis. You know, slightly tilted, and if I average over phase, it looks like I will lose all the information. But if we look back at the spectrometer, so that's the RF coil, the signal comes back. And we put it into a mixer. And we take the difference in frequency. So I'm always using this signal as a reference. And regardless of what this phase is, the NMR signal always lags it by 90 degrees. So when I mix these two, this phase drops out. And so to make the system complicated, what people would do is they would run this synthesizer continuously. And then they would trigger their experiment off the zero crossing of the cosine. And then they would worry that they needed to get the phase right, and so they would double it and do the whole thing again. But this phase, in fact, doesn't matter because the system is cylindrically symmetric. Now, of course, after you give the first pulse, the system is no longer cylindrically symmetric. But that still doesn't matter because this is running with one constant frequency. And the precision with which we can have a synthesizer run with a constant frequency is very, very good. So everything comes out. Yeah? And you can see that sometimes, of course, we've had X pulses and Y pulses, and that is just a phase change of the synthesizer, just as though we put in a small piece of cable here to delay the RF.
So not only does the phase drop out, but it can be non-uniform for each?
It is uniform for each. So you have one macroscopic coil, and that same coil is interacting with all the spins. Oh. I had multiple coils, I didn't have to worry about it, but this is one coil, and all the spins do the same field.
Okay, so the frame is rotating with respect to the RF coil, not with respect to the sound.
That's right. The frame, we choose the interaction frame exactly to coincide to the radio frequency field that we apply, which is well specified. Now, of course, we did see that there's a T2 that says the spins dephase, and that is exactly the loss of that particular phase coherence.
Okay.
Yeah? Other questions? No? Okay. All right, so for the last time, I want to write down the block equations. And oh, that's okay. I think I'm going to run out of room for what I wanted to do, but we'll make it work. Now, one of the things that I meant to tell you every time I wrote down the block equations, and I failed to each and every time, was that the block equations can't be generalized beyond a single step. You can, of course, create some mishmash of a set of rules to describe the evolution of the system given two coupled spins. But you have to keep every coherence. You have to keep every possible correlation. And so now then you have to have, you know, not six of these terms, you have to have something for every component of the system, right? So if you're, so you need 16 of those things. And it blows up and it's a mess to write down. So the block equations have this nice compact form, but it is only true for SU2. Beyond that, you know, the power of quantum mechanics, as soon as you can have entanglement, the power of quantum mechanics really does become evident, and you can't have these simple structures. Yeah?
So the basic spin, one
species of spin. Yes, I mean that you have one spin that's not interacting with any other spin. Just a block equation. Now, if we take and look at these and we think about DiVincenzo's rules, right?
Then should be T2, the second last term.
Yeah, this is T2?
No, the one
these are both T1. This is spin last. Taking us back to thermal equilibrium. So this piece here is the piece that governs can we prepare a state to initialize. Our ability to distinguish qubits says that, hey, we need to have different resonance frequencies or different spins. So this has to vary with or qubits. We saw that T2, which is going to be one of our errors, one over T2 had a frequency squared and a correlation times squared, right? That let me call it RMS.
that there is a term that says, yes, I have some width of a distribution. The width of the distribution matters if it's varying in time. Yeah. So here we have this piece.
In T1, down here, we saw that it had a dipolar frequency squared. And then instead of a correlation time, it had a set of special densities at different frequencies. Remember, those frequencies came from looking at the correlation in second-order perturbation theory, looking at the correlation of the dipolar Hamiltonian. And because these terms don't commute with the quantizing, the Zeeman Hamiltonian, when we try to remove the frequency dependence of the dipolar term, then to get those terms to be static, so we can measure a correlation function. If it was a flip-flop term, sigma plus plus, sigma plus times sigma minus plus sigma minus times sigma plus, that's a zero frequency contribution. If it was a term that looked like sigma plus or sigma minus times sigma z, then those show up at the Zeeman frequency. And if there's the double quantum term, sigma plus, or sigma minus, those show up at the double frequency. Okay, so we had to worry about these particular. And these things take the place of the correlation time. And they simply say, given the modulation of the dipolar Hamiltonian by some random motion, or perhaps some other spin, we're just going to take those frequency components. And that would be an amplitude that we can control. All right. There were some other pieces I wanted to say here. The fact that we have a mapping really isn't, so DiVincenzo's rule that we have an efficient mapping really doesn't come from the block equations. It comes from the fact that if we're looking at the dynamics of multiple spins, there's a Kronecker product structure. And so given the Kronecker product structure, we have an efficient mapping. And of course, the fact that there's a complete set of gates says that there's a scalar coupling, which again is not part of the block equations. All right, so we have all this. Now, we were worrying about errors and controlling errors. And we saw that if the errors were coming in as T2. I mean, T2 is a very graceful way for errors to come in. It says that there's a variation in some z part of the Hamiltonian, so there's some variation in energy. And the precession frequency gets varied as we change that energy, right? Delta omega is the energy term. And so these two terms get scrambled, but nothing happens to sigma z. Yeah? And that in the case where omega 1 tau sub c is much, much greater than 1, in this case where the variations in the z components of the Hamiltonian seem to be slowly varying compared to how fast we can modulate the system, then we have active means of controlling. We saw that decoupling, the same equivalent of creating an echo, that they would remove that inhomogeneity. And that's actually familiar to us from classical control theory, that if we have some slow variation in my modulation depth, the rate at which I can modulate a system is high, then I can remove that variation. And that's not so surprising. We are in SU2 isomorphic to SO3, and so that the classical control laws should apply. And the control laws that we know say that if the power bandwidth limit, the power bandwidth limit controls the precision with which we can remove errors, just in the feedback sense. And that's the same argument that we have here. Power 1 over the time is the bandwidth. Right, so power bandwidth limit we can control. Now, if this isn't the case, then we saw that that if omega 1 tau sub c is of order 1 or less than 1, that we can't use this decoupling sequence, but if the noise has a symmetry, we can still remove it. And we looked at a really simple version of that, where we said that we had two spins that saw exactly the same field. And then we had a logical encoding of the up-down states of those two spins in two qubits. And so there's a bit of an inefficiency here, that we're going to use multiple spins to code one qubit, but in fact, we don't care about small inefficiencies. All we care about is scaling loss, and so that would actually be quite a good thing. Okay. Now I want to look at what happens with T1. If you think about T1 errors. T1 says that there's a loss of energy to the lattice. And you know, it's very simple, very easy to say, just throw up your hands and say, well, you can't do anything because you've lost the energy to the lattice and, you know, go away. And there's a lot of bad arguments like that. And you know, we need to look a little bit deeper than that. In the first place we're going to look is to show you that with very modest engineering, we can create a generator which doesn't allow the system evolve. Okay, so in this case, all we need to do is look at the Hamiltonians. So I'm going to look at the Hamiltonians. Now, the Hamiltonian I'm going to look at is the Hamiltonian causing relaxation. Okay, so what I'm interested in is not the average over a process. I'm interested in the Hamiltonian with its fast fluctuations, because I want to see how it causes relaxation down here. So we say that we have a Hamiltonian as a function of time, and I'm going to add two components to it. The first one, I'm going to write it like this. Okay, so let me label these things. And let me show you molecularly what I'm modeling here, so we're all on the same page. I'm going to imagine that I have two spin 1/2 nuclei. In this case, I'm going to take carbon and proton. And I'll tell you that the gyromagnetic ratio of proton divided by carbon is very close to 4. Okay, so if I think about the dipolar Hamiltonian, and remember that in a dipolar Hamiltonian, we had this frequency term of 0 because the two spins could flip. But that's only true if the two spins are the same nuclear species. And here, because the gyromagnetic ratios are a factor of 4 different, if the two spins flip, it'll cost a lot more energy, 4 times the energy to flip a proton as to flip a carbon. So this term, this flip-flop term, isn't important. And so the one that remains is here, but in fact, the term that is dominates the structure is this bilinear term, sigma z, sigma z. Here, I'm looking at, so this is the dipolar interaction of, let me just write that down, carbon and proton. and we just keep this one as cropped. Yeah.
Why is there an asymmetry to that, that it depends on the sigma z of carbon and not on the sigma z of the hydrogen?
Because I haven't described the term yet.
Okay.
I'll explain.
One other question, though.
Yeah.
What's theta?
I'll explain.
Okay.
I'll give the whole description.
This term is the chemical shift in sigma is the so-called screening constant. Sigma is telling us what the Lenz law reduction of the magnetic field is that the nuclear spin sees. Okay, remember that we said that this was about 1 part in 10^5. And I just wanted to keep the fact that this is dependent, this is proportional to the magnetic field strength. And the dipolar interaction is not proportional to the magnetic field strength. Okay. So now then, what we're going to do is to take this bond angle. I should have left myself more room. And that bond angle relative to the static magnetic field is what's going to fluctuate in this case. So this molecule is going to tumble. As it tumbles, the dipolar interaction between the two spins is modulated, and the screening potential is modulated. And it turns out that in this particular case, this isn't in general true, but in this particular case, the principal axis system of these two interactions are the same, and they both have axial symmetry. So then I can rewrite this. And I'll rewrite this to look like sigma as an amplitude now, 1 − 3 cos² θ of t, b zero, sigma z c, plus omega d, 1 − 3 cos² θ of t, sigma ZC, sigma Z proton. Yeah? And now you can see what I want to do. That this, and remember that there's an identity term here for the proton. That'll be useful. Okay? Now I'm going to take this identity term and expand it in terms of these idempotents. So remember that this is the projectors of proton up and down. And of course, sigma z. Can be expanded into the same idempotents, but there's a negative sign there. Yeah. So I've done a few things. One, I've dropped the Z1 energy. So this piece here is omega naught. And since that's the quantization axis, I just dropped that term. Okay? And then I said that because this term has axial symmetry, then the variation in this term looks like the second Legendre polynomial. Okay, and so now I've just written it as expanding that. Okay, and this term has axial symmetry, so it has the same variation. And then there's the third piece of magic, which says that for these compounds, the principal axis for the chemical shift and for the dipolar interaction coincide. Okay, and you can go back to some molecular orbital structure and argue why that should be the case. It actually depends upon how accurately that's the case, depends upon what constituents you put here. Okay, so then let's just expand this out. And so now we have a Hamiltonian as a function of time. And I'm just going to write it dependent upon the idempotence of the proton, so that if we have E plus, then we see a term which is sigma. And let's take this term out of everything, because it actually won't lead to any nice physics. We'll just leave it out there. So if I have E plus, then we have sigma B zero sigma Z plus omega D sigma Z. And why don't I take sigma Z out too? Yeah. Plus E minus, which will look like that. And now you find a very, very nice thing, that I can choose a magnetic field strength so that this term goes to zero. If I choose B zero carefully. And what does that mean? It says that the generators of the relaxation disappear. There are no generators of relaxation if the proton is pointed down. Now, of course, there are higher order terms and there's more things that go on, but this is the dominant source of relaxation. And so if I took the carbon spin, so we have some resonance for carbon. So that's omega, there's omega C, it has some width to it. And then I add the scalar coupling. Add the scalar coupling with proton. Then we would expect to have two lines separated by 2 pi times J. And then if I add this decoherence, add the noise, then one of these would remain sharp and the other one would be broad. Okay, and this, therefore, would be the case that the proton spin is down. And that would be the proton spin is up. This turns out to be an important effect, that when we look at proteins and we try to use NMR to measure protein structure, one of the dominant research activities of NMR, if your protein becomes bigger and bigger, and of course we like to look at big proteins, this dipolar interaction leads to very broad lines. It was thought that there was nothing you could do about that. And then it was realized that in fact, if they turn the magnetic field up a little bit higher, that they would have this condition. And as long as they're willing to select out only one of these isochromats, they could still do their experiments. So here we see for T1, one nice process that we can just arrange the generators to drop out. Of course, it's by symmetry, right? It's a cancellation of generators. Happens at a Hamiltonian level. And nicely, we remove the decoherence of the system. Yeah?
that remove the decoherence if we still have the E plus term?
Well, the E plus term says that this line is removed. So I simply do my calculation conditional on the proton being here, being in this state.
But is that completely general for computation then? I mean,
well, I can't use the proton for computation, but I can use the carbon for computation.
Okay.
Right? So yes, it's very much like this case. That we've added a resource, an additional spin, to achieve the suppression of the noise. But notice that the noise is fully removed here. Since we've suppressed the generators, this is not some small time approximation or anything that says it's completely gone. Now I want to look at a few other ways of removing the noise. Okay. So that says that we can remove noise if we can find this cancellation of Hamiltonians. Actually, that's not so different from this case, right? That I could have said, oh, I have one Hamiltonian for the B-naught field on one spin, one Hamiltonian for the B-naught field on the other spin that they cancel. And so, yeah, that's about the same thing there. Now I want to remove the dipolar coupling completely. And this is... this was a very surprising result when it was created. It was systemized by John Waugh, observed by some other people without them realizing the full power. John realized what this was telling people. Okay, so we have a sequence of four pulses. And the first thing I have you notice is that in the absence of any dynamics between the pulses, these pulses don't do anything. That here I have a 90-degree pulse about the y-axis. This is a 90-degree pulse about the minus y-axis. So if I brought those together, they do nothing, right? You rotate and rotate back. This is a 90-degree pulse about the x-axis and a 90-degree pulse about the minus x-axis. So they don't do anything either. So if I wanted to reduce this, I said that there's no Hamiltonians in between, then the propagator for the RF is simply the identity. That's the only piece I have. Okay? But that won't be the interesting case. Now I want to look at a set of Hamiltonians, and we're going to look at these at these components of a Hamiltonian. I write them out this way because I want to look at them separately. Okay. And these all commute with each other, so you know, life is easy. This piece here is what we were talking about before. This is a chemical shift. These two pieces come from the dipolar interaction. Remember that this sigma dot sigma, that's the energy, that's a flip-flop motion. That allows the spin information to move through a lattice. And sigma z is going to shift the energy, yeah? And of course, I left the sigma z in here. Yeah, I could have changed that, but I want it like this. Okay, now, What I want to do is to take this series of pulses, and I want to describe for that series of pulses an effective Hamiltonian. Now, clearly, for this series of pulses, I can describe a propagator for that. And so I could just label these actions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yeah? And I could say, oh yeah, this is easy. That U over this cycle is equal to U, well, let me write it down, as e to the I H1 T1, e to the I H2 T2, e to the I H9 T9. Yeah? And that's perfectly defined. And then I can say, well, okay, this thing is equal to e to the I H bar, and we'll define this total time as tau sub c, just to label it, tau sub c. And that's well defined. Okay? Now, I can't just take all these terms and add them up, okay, because they don't commute, or in general, they don't commute, right? And so we'll have to be a little bit careful about how we add those up. But what I can do is I can say, oh, well, let me take some approximations of these, okay? And so clearly, I can say that, H bar is equal to and we'll take H sub 0 as just the average. So 1 over tau sub c H summation H sub I T sub I. That'll be the first term in the approximation. And then I can say, well, okay, what would this term be? And this term would be I over twice tau sub c summation I less than j of h sub j tau sub j h sub I tau sub I, right? Be the sum of the commutators, that would be the first term. And you've seen these things in terms of Trotter expansions or Suzuki or Magnus or Baker-Campbell-Hans, Hausdorff. The thing gets published or was published many, many times in many communities. And there it is. And of course, we don't have the right to truncate it here, the second order, the third order. You can write them all down, and they're relatively simple to write down. But they're all going to show up, of course, as averaging. So we're going to work in the regime where omega 1 is greater. I'll just say it's greater than the dipolar frequency. We're going to work in the regime where we can strongly modulate this. And so if we make the action in each of these intervals small, if we run the whole thing really quick, then we have some expectation that the lower order averages will be true. And it turns out that via Floquet theory, you can quantify this. So we can test the convergence, we can bound the convergence. But let's just see how it works right now. So I'm going to take and look at the averaging of these Hamiltonians over the cycle. But I want to do one more thing first. I want to assume that these radio frequency pulses happen really fast and strong. So I'm going to I'm not going to integrate over the radio frequency pulses. We're going to say that this is an instantaneous rotation, and so I'll be able to remove that. It happens sharply. I don't need to make this approximation, but it's going to save me boards of algebra. having made that approximation, I'm going to take and write these Hamiltonians down in the interaction frame of the pulse sequence. Okay, so what we're going to do is transform those Hamiltonians by these RF pulses. So if I have sigma z, well, okay, this is the first interval. There's nothing happens. It's really sigma z. If it's transformed by this x pulse, well, then it's going to be minus sigma 1. Now, remember that what I'm doing is taking sigma z in this window and transforming it back so I can add it in the original frame. So when I want to transform sigma z from this window, I have to apply the operations in reverse order. OK, so if I have sigma z, and I transform by 90-degree pulse about y, and then that would give me sigma x. And of course, the sigma x pulse won't rotate that. And so in this window, this is sigma x. This is minus sigma y. And this better be sigma z. And it is, in fact, because the propagator for the full cycle is the identity. OK, so then we can say, what is h bar? Well, let's say, what is h0? What's the zeroth order approximation of that? And we can see that this is there for 2 tau. This is there for tau, but there's another one over there. This is there for tau, but there's another one over there. And so we end up having that it's 1/3 sigma x minus sigma y plus sigma z. Yeah.
Why can't we write down the
propagators
as 4
out 2, 4, 6, 9? Because I've assumed that they're instantaneous, and so they're happening at no time. Therefore, when I take a time average, since the time is equal to 0, they don't interact. I can write them down, do the same analysis. I'll get virtually the same result. The conclusion will be exactly the same, except it'll take a lot more algebra.
So
taking them to a delta.
Okay.
If I look at sigma dot sigma, doesn't matter what we do to sigma dot sigma, it stays the same, right? So it's an isotropic term. So sigma dot sigma is always sigma dot sigma, and it comes through sigma dot sigma. No scaling at all. If we take this term sigma z, and the pulses are going to rotate both spins. So here, it's sigma z. During this time, it's sigma y. Here, sigma x, sigma y, sigma z. So when I add those up, we get 1/3 sigma dot sigma. And the dipolar Hamiltonian was sigma dot sigma plus 3 sigma z. So when I add these two up, so I multiply this by omega d, I multiply this by 3 omega d, and I should get my signs right. That's a negative sign. I apologize for that. I add these up, and what you get out, of course, is 0. That the dipolar interaction goes to 0. And this was really surprising. This said that what had been treated for decades as an irrecoverable loss of information, and has been used as a way of talking about the second law, and in fact, wasn't an irrecoverable loss in information. It was a recoverable loss of information. And it's one of the nice early demonstrations that we should be expected to do quantum computing, because what was happening is that the information is moving through the lattice under this Hamiltonian and is being stored in the other spins. And since there was, in fact, no mechanism for decoherence, that information was recoverable. And it's recoverable by effectively changing the sign of the dipolar interaction and allowing the dipolar interaction to cancel out the evolution. In other words, we can send the system back in time. Okay. And now, there's a good question of, does this suppress T1? And if the T1 is governed by some relaxation sink, then yes, it does. And so let me show you that. I'll lose this. It's often the case that we have some set of spins and their relaxation is controlled, for instance, by an electron spin. So we have an electron spin. Remember that the magnetic moment of the electron is about 700 times that of the proton. And the T1 of the electron is short. And so the electron spin has a large fluctuating dipolar magnet. As that fluctuates, the nuclear spins surrounding it see a relaxation source. They see a fluctuating field. And to the extent that that fluctuating field has one of these frequencies, and if it's fluctuating quickly, it does have all of those frequencies, then these spins will relax quickly. But then you have some spin out here. You say, well, how does this one relax? Well, it doesn't relax directly from that fluctuating field. What it relaxes from is this flip-flop process that carries the information between those two. And this process, we turn off here. And so in the case where we have an electron spin that's mediating in the case where spin diffusion is connecting different pools of spins, then running these sequences removes that connection and the T1s become long. And a good example is a diamond, that if you have a clean diamond, then we never see the system relax. That you can leave it in your magnet for months, it will still not be polarized because there's not enough phonons and there's not enough electrons. If you take a diamond that is more interesting, that has some color to it, then it has electrons, and now there's a faster relaxation mechanism. And then if you run these sequences, you can suppress that relaxation and return to having a long relaxation time. Okay, so we have control over decoherence even in the dipolar case via such modulation sequences. And these things have been generalized so that given a set of Hamiltonians. Remember that this is a time-independent Hamiltonian. We can find a way of refocusing. Okay, so that gives us almost the last. It says that hey, we have a scheme of refocusing, so coherent control, or refocusing not the dynamics, but the Hamiltonian, right? That in this case, we didn't talk about how the spins evolve at all. All we talked about is what the Hamiltonian would look like if we coarse-grained it over some time interval. The last approach. These are all really powerful approaches that we've described because they are true as long as you have the right symmetries, that they're true, period. You can completely suppress decoherence. And then there's approaches that are more powerful in a different way. They're more powerful because they're more general, but they're only going to suppress the noise in the short time limit. You have a question?
Yeah, if you don't mind a little reference one. You talked about no phonons in a crystal being, it meaning that you have practically an infinite relaxation time.
Yeah.
Was that what allowed the experimenters to, that pair of experimenters to mail an entangled qubit? Or?
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll be here sometime.
That's
okay. There are a lot of these things where you have protected information that should be around for a long time. Okay, so now I want to talk about an example of a quantum error correcting code. And I'm going to discuss it first in terms of a circuit diagram. And then we'll discuss it in terms of the underlying physics. So the idea is that I have one qubit that I want to protect, one spin, and this spin is precious to me. I want to keep its coherent, and it's in some arbitrary state. And then I'm going to add two ancilla. I'm going to use those ancilla to preserve the information. And then I'm going to preserve that information regardless of the state and regardless of the noise, provided the noise happens infinitesimally. So I'm going to assume that the noise here has a set of Krauss operators, which is P1 for sigma x on spin 1, identity, P2 for identity, sigma x2, identity, and 2, 3, 1, 3, P3 for identity, sigma x3. And then, of course, we need one more, that is 1 minus P1, P2, P3, times the identity on all. And so what we're saying is that we only allow one error to happen in this system. That's all that is allowed. And it looks like I've run out of time, so I'll have to talk about this tomorrow. You see that we create a set of control NOT gates. These control NOT gates are going to map us into this entangled, potentially entangled state. It's entangled depending upon what the values of alpha and beta are. Okay. And then we'll look at how the error occurs. And at this point here, we're going to end up in a density matrix where I'm going to think about a 2x2 that is this spin labeled by these. Right? So I have 4 2x2 matrices, right, in this Hilbert space. I have a 2x2, a 2x2, a 2x2, and a 2x2. And this is the 2x2 if both 2 and 3 are up. And this one, plus, minus, minus, plus, and minus, minus. And I want to end up in this case. I want to end up in this block subdiagonal. And we'll see that this particular sequence allows us to do that, and that this density matrix, this reduced density matrix, for that particular case, this will be correct, this will be correct, this will be correct, and this one will have a sigma x error.
And you can see that what this does is it corrects that error, and then I can trace out over this. And if I correct this error so that they're all correct, and then I trace out, throw away that information, I'm going to reduce this down to a simple correct 2x2. And to the extent that it really has this form, then we'll recover all the information. Now, this is a nice way to see it. It's a way to see it in terms of generators. Here we're talking about Krauss operators and generators. You wonder, well, how does it connect to having a T1? And when this was first suggested, you know, it was seen in physics communities as incorrect because they said, hey, I only have a T1. You know, I'm only losing information. Does this still hold true? And of course it does. And we'll show you that tomorrow. Questions?